Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. Happy 4th of July.
Yes, we're a special July 4th broadcast.
2018, okay, and it's been quite a wild 3rd and 4th of July. Crazy weather, but a lot of nature's fireworks last night, actually.
Right, but it's calmed down. And we're looking forward to a more traditional 4th with a lot of fireworks. Although, we may not, I don't know what we're going to see or what we're not going to see. But there was an article in the paper about fireworks just today, which speaks to a trend which I wasn't onto, which is, I don't know if it's worrisome or not, but let me see what you think. The Times did have a very useful breakdown of what the fantastic fireworks at Macy's are like. And of course, we can't talk about this much without the pictures, but you'll be interested to know that the different firework patterns have names.
Are you going to describe those fireworks?
No, I'm not. I'll just give you the names. I'll just give you two or three names, like the Saturn blue with red ring and silver tail. That's pretty descriptive. Or the gold to blue croisette, if you know what croisette means. The crackling palms. It goes on from there. So whatever you see in terms of fireworks, it's already been classified. There's a taxonomy.
It seems like there are a lot of fireworks in the sky. How could you ever keep up and be able to name each one?
Well, you can't. But what's interesting to me is there is the real professional fireworks, so the type we're talking about when we're talking about Macy's and the croisettes. And there is the amateurs out there who have fireworks, or what I think of more likely firecrackers. And
No, that's a really different thing.
It might be a different thing, but I think for the purpose of classifying is what's going on in terms of what people are setting off, it's really, there are trends that, are a little bit puzzling.
Did you have fireworks growing up in your backyard?
No.
Anyone in your neighborhood?
No.
No.
They did them at the movie theater nearby, the drive-in.
And at the Mets.
No, they didn't do them then at the Mets, I don't think. Maybe they did.
Well, when you were a little bit.
I wouldn't know. We didn't go. But
once you drove me to Shea Stadium,
I was all grown
we didn't
up
even go to the game, but we watched the fireworks from outside Shea Stadium.
Okay.
That was not part of growing up. Well, you were already grown up then? Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is that went to the Garrucci brothers, and you had to wait until the development of the Garrucci brothers in Long Island to link up with the Mets, and I don't know where they were. The other thing you have to realize is the Mets didn't exist when I was very young, so it's a little complicated. But we did have Westbury driving.
And it was my father set out fireworks once in a while. Yeah. Like if we had been on some trip somewhere where they sold fireworks.
Yeah.
And he would buy a box and, a few Roman candles in the backyard kind of thing, but not extensively.
Yeah, we were told they were dangerous and we tended to believe it.
They seem dangerous.
But here's what's crazy to me is that, there's almost $1 billion spent in this country for fireworks last year, right? But a lot of them are for personal use. What's interesting is that the amount of fireworks purchased for small-scale use, let's call that personal use, between 2002 and 2017 has doubled, right? Whereas the amount of fireworks purchased for displays like Macy's display and other professional displays has declined, right? From 64 million pounds to 25 million pounds in the same period.
Well, that's weird.
It is weird. It's totally weird. So the trend is less in the way of the big-time professional fireworks, more in the way of the personal explosions in your backyard.
And that's crazy.
It's crazy.
I told you, I really thought that with that big accident, what's his name, the football player?
Jean-Pierre Paul.
Jean-Pierre Paul of the Giants.
Right.
Blowing off his finger or whatever.
Right. Blew off a finger. Yes.
And that got a great deal of notoriety. Right. I would have thought that people would take the hint and say, wow, could happen to me.
And it didn't. When I was young, I did know somebody, didn't live in my neighborhood, but someone I met at a camp I was at, who actually had a terrible accident with fireworks, and he was scarred for life. It would happen every once in a while. But not enough, apparently, to put off the trend of the last few years. So I don't get it. I've never gotten it. I enjoy the big fireworks shows to a fair degree, but I'm not a guy to light up glass bottles in my backyard.
Yes.
I don't have that gene.
And in Cranberry,
Ah, the fireworks are
always on the 5th of July.
The 5th of July.
Because they get them cheaper.
Exactly. And people at work laugh hysterically when I tell them that. But that is, you know, that's, you know, municipal management. That's responsible management. That's the way to go. I'm with them.
It's very handy for us because we're often away from Cranberry on the 4th of July.
But we'll be there on the 5th.
We'll be there on the 5th. And what is better than to just sit out on a nice, warm, humid, buggy night in New Jersey waiting for those fireworks to start?
On July 5th.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it. So we did see a movie this weekend. We saw The Catcher Was a Spy, which is a movie about a former baseball player called Mo Berg, who played for 17 years in the big leagues in the 30s and early 40s. And he was always somewhat distinguished from the other players. And I have to say, as a figure who was known to me and my family growing up, everyone had heard of Mo Berg.
Never heard of Mo Berg.
In my temple, because he was Jewish. There weren't many Jewish players. And the other thing that distinguished Mo Berg was he was highly educated. So
yes.
Mo Berg was a guy who went to Princeton.
Right.
And he went to Columbia Law School.
Right.
And as we learned in the movie, he spoke 7 or 8 languages. And so...
Yeah, he had also been to the Sorbonne.
Right.
So were you feeling kind of a link there?
Right, because I went
to... Because you went to Princeton, you went to Columbia Law.
I think Zeke summed it up best. When Zeke heard where he went to school and that he spoke all these languages, he said to me, "Well, Dad, it's sort of like your story if you had applied yourself." I said, "Yes, thanks, Zeke. Thanks very much." But what the real story is for the movie is that he was in the OSS during World War II.
He became a spy.
He became a spy. And he was given the...
And why not? With all those languages.
Well, of course, that's exactly why he got the job, because he spoke all these languages. And he was given the assignment of finding, speaking to, and possibly assassinating Heisenberg, the great physicist of Germany who was developing or thought to be developing the atomic bomb for the Nazis. The assignment that came to Berg was to determine whether, in fact, Heisenberg was actively working for the Nazis and trying to help them win the war, or given what was perceived as Heisenberg's somewhat ambivalent attitude about the Nazis, whether he really wasn't trying to have the Nazis succeed and was maybe even sabotaging their efforts, in which case you wouldn't want to assassinate him.
Well, that sounds all very complicated, but what did you think of the movie?
I thought the movie was good. I enjoyed it. It was a little old-fashioned, which was fine.
Old-fashioned, just spy thriller.
Yeah, it was a straight narrative.
Yeah.
It was a very clear narrative. He had the the tension to see whether he could accomplish what he had to accomplish. You had character development. You had things proceed in a stately way, and you had success or not success. So it was a conventional
crowded
movie.
Crowded theater.
And
all people who possibly knew Mo Berg.
Well, because they were older. Yes, they were all older. But that's that theater. That theater attracts a lot of older people, and it isn't the first. It isn't a a theater that's going to show a lot of animated films or Marvel films. It's a smaller theater.
But he was truly an enigma, a crazy kind of guy.
Well,
hard to understand.
That was the principal theme of the movie.
Yeah.
Was that he was unknowable. That he was there was an inner conflict, that there were parts of him which didn't jive. And the principal inconsistency, if you will, or the principal things that they could not reconcile in his personality, frankly, was that he was on the one hand a ball player and on the other hand something of an intellectual. And that is something that always befuddles people, and maybe because...
Did you have that problem going on?
I wasn't that good a ball player. No, it always throws people, even on a professional level, or at least they're skeptical of it. And
we like the pigeonhole people. We like
We like the pigeonhole people. And it makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that was clearly the problem that Mo Berg ran into. And by coincidence, there was an article in the Times just this past week, and there was a long interview of Kyrie Irving.
Who's Kyrie Irving?
Who is
one
of the top ball players in the National Basketball Association, the NBA.
Basketball player.
An all-star NBA player who was a teammate for one important season of LeBron James, for example. One of the top players. And he is, in fact, the creative force, if we can use that term, behind the Uncle Drew movie that's about to be released.
I think it's already in the theaters.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So, and that gets a lot of play and a lot of advertisements. And And we won't be seeing it, and nor will the other older people in the theater who are with us be seeing that movie. So that's why I hesitate to call creative force. But in any event, on that level, he is worthy of an interview, a long interview, in the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times.
The Arts and Leisure section?
Exactly right, because he's creative. And what the interviewer gets hung up on is that there was something on the social media, some comment by Kyrie Irving, which caught a lot of play, that he thinks the world is flat. The earth is flat. And this interviewer was really going to nail him down on that and went back four or five questions in the Times about, but you're saying it's flat, and do you really believe it's flat, and are you concerned that young people are going to believe it's flat? It was like that kind of thing. It was a pretty bad interview.
So what was the reaction in social media? Did they think he was an idiot?
Or yes. They were saying, yeah, these NBA guys, they make a zillion dollars and they're morons. Now, so what is Kyrie's education? Kyrie's education is he one of these guys who went straight from high school to college? No. He spent a year at, guess what, Duke. But apparently, he didn't take any philosophy at Duke, because had he might have been able to set the interviewer straight. And I'm crediting Irving much more than I'm crediting the interviewer here. Because what Irving's really about, and you read the interview and he just has trouble saying or making it clear to the interviewer, is he's not really saying the earth is flat. He's saying people ought to question everything. And that when you look at something, you hear something, what is apparent isn't always the case. And what we learn in philosophy, in epistemology, which is the whole subject of, learning and knowing, is the perfect example is you have a pencil and a glass of water that's half filled. And when you look at it, because of the way light refracts, the pencil looks bent in half, or at least disjointed. And the question, the philosophical question is, is the pencil really disjointed? And the answer is no. And the question then is, how do you know? How do you really know? Because what you're looking at looks disjointed. And that takes you into a philosophical discussion. And that's what he's saying. He's raising an epistemological debate. He's saying, everyone assumes, everyone thinks they know. But how do you really know? That's what he wants to talk about. And again, what I think the reason the interviewer misses the boat is because you wouldn't think that a sports person, in this case a basketball player, is onto something that's philosophical, intellectual. That's just not in the range of what the conversation could be about. It's more likely he's just confused. He thinks the earth is flat. So you see it even in the present day. So in any event, I think the movie's worth seeing. You think it's worth seeing.
Yeah, worth seeing. Who was the woman in it? Sienna Miller. Beautiful. Right. His longtime love interest.
And you had
Who else was in it?
Paul Giamatti. Paul Giamatti's in it, and Mark Strong is in it.
And who was the general? Jeff Daniels. So a lot of fun people. And just a little aside about, to finish up on Mo Berg, he continues to be an enigma. After the war, he works for the OSS a little while longer, but then he never has another job in his life.
Yeah, so he's really an odd duck all the way through, even more odd than the movie makes him seem.
And he lives with his brother for a while. His brother kicks him out. He ends up living with his sister in New Jersey. Yeah. And eventually, just before he passes away in New Jersey, the last words he says are, "How'd the Mets do today?"
Well, that's the one normal thing about him. He was focused on the right thing, right?
Lots of connections there. Yeah. Catcher was a spy.
Paul Rudd played the main part. I don't know if we even said that, but it's worth seeing. And we want to talk about a couple of things that we'd referred to in the previous week because they're kind of interesting follow-ups. One is Carmen Jones. Carmen Jones, which is at the Classic Stage Company. And I should mention, I'm on the board of Classic Stage.
Full disclosure.
That is full disclosure. Not that it would affect anything I say about the merits of production.
Not at all.
But we did think it was great. But what's interesting is that when we talked about it last week, it hadn't been reviewed. And of course, this is the version of the opera Carmen written by Bizet to which Oscar Hammerstein put words. And it was presented at Classic Stage with an African-American cast. It's set, instead of in Bizet's Carmen, it's set in like 1940s in a military base in the U.S., which gives it a different flavor. And it's a very small theater. It's a 200-person theater. It's a a small but quite capable orchestra, and it's a wonderful cast, but they're singing
it's like five or six pieces.
Five or six pieces. Okay.
Orchestra.
Small.
It's a totally different level of
production. But it's more intimate, and yet it's very effective. So the question, what we were asking ourselves, is how is it going to be reviewed, particularly because, and this I can tell you based on my experience with the theater, is the reviews in the big papers, and particularly the Times, mean everything to a production like this.
In a theater like this.
Right. There are other reviews that don't matter. I mean, Mean Girls, the review was tepid. It doesn't make any difference. Frozen, the reviews are bad. It doesn't make any difference. This makes a difference. They can't get to first base with an audience without a good review in the Times. And they got a fantastic review in the Times with a huge cover photo Thursday, June 28th.
Above the fold.
It's called Sublime. They say it was incredibly challenging to do this. And yet it could have gone so wrong. But the way they sum it up is music is character, it's destiny, its sweep is such that the lines between speech and song are eradicated, it is smashingly effective. So that's a brilliant review for them, which is a great thing. And then the question becomes, what do you do with this? I mean, they extended the run 3 weeks into August, but it's still a small theater and only a limited number of people are going to see it. And there's talk about, do you take it to Broadway? And there are a couple of examples of small productions and small theaters that go to Broadway, like Chorus Line, like Hamilton. And it doesn't happen often. And that's a tough thing. That's a big deal. There was a review in the Journal. The Journal also loved it, by their reviewer, Terry Teachout. But he made a point of saying, so the question is, does it go to Broadway? He has that in his review. Mm-hmm. And he says, there's a lot to this. I can see it going to Broadway, but it would only work on Broadway if it was bigger, if you really had a full orchestra. And maybe this cast can work, maybe their voices are big enough, but there'd have to be more invested in the production. You need that for it. And he says, I think some producer will get behind it and do that. Then he closed the review by saying, but that's an aside, this is great.
I just can't imagine that, because I feel like one of the things I loved about it was the intimacy.
Right.
I would be shocked if they can really morph it into a big production brouhaha.
Yeah, I don't know that I disagree.
You know, I think it's an entirely different product than it was as an opera. Mm-hmm. So I'd be shocked.
But
if it could work,
do you think you can just take that to a Broadway theater in the way it's done now, in the intimate way, and you think it would work in a big theater?
You know, I don't really know. And you know, I'm not a producer.
Let me ask you one more question, which you might say, you know, and is there an audience for that?
That's a good question. You know, the only reason I'm hesitant, because I did love it a lot, mm-hmm. and I was surprised,
right.
and is that I did actually go to the internet and heard a little smidge of the original cast recording of mm-hmm. Hammerstein's production of Carmen Jones.
Right.
And it was awful. I could not stand
right.
to listen to it.
Yeah.
So it makes you nervous that somebody is going to foof this all up.
Yeah.
There's something to John Doyle's production, his minimalist approach, that really seemed to work, that seemed to embrace these voices and the people in it. I think
you're getting to the heart of it. I don't know if there's an answer to that question, but someone's going to have to answer that question.
But it was an interesting project, and we're delighted with the at least theoretical success.
Yeah. No, it's successful. There's nothing theoretical about what they've got going right now. All right, so you saw something as a follow-up to the Mr. Rogers movie.
Well, just that in listening to Fresh Air.
Yeah.
On NPR, Terry Gross interviewing an old interview from the 1980s of Fred Rogers. And so I'd been thinking about Fred Rogers because of the documentary we saw, Won't You Be My Neighbor? And of course, that was a very sort of positive, warm and fuzzy documentary The whole audience we were with was in tears. In many scenes, it was very, very touching. But it was interesting to hear him talk to Terry Gross, and he did talk to Terry Gross just as he talks to small children.
Yeah.
Very deliberate, very careful. So that was interesting. Various things he said just made you wonder, just made you think a little bit about there is possibly more to the story of Fred Rogers.
Well, I got the feeling the movie, which you're right, is edited and arranged and curated to tell a simple, single, positive story. And I think overall it is a positive story, of course. But I think he probably did have some limitations in terms of communicating with adults. And he had a different comfort level in talking with adults.
Right. They do mention in the movie that when one of his sons mentions that when he had something important to say to the family, he used one of the puppet voices.
Right. That's a tell, yeah.
But also, I'm just talking about his life was much more complex. He actually develops the program in Canada, mm-hmm. And then buys the rights and brings it back mm-hmm. to Pittsburgh. I thought it was all just, you know, flowed seamlessly. Mm-hmm.
It's another one of those years in the making overnight successes.
Right. Yeah. He actually gets his seminary degree on his lunch hour, working in Pittsburgh
over many years. Right.
And then he's about to get some great job. Job falls through. He's, you know, has no alternatives. And then out of the blue comes this offer from Canada, Canadian Broadcasting. And there are a lot of twists and turns, I think, that would be interesting to know about.
Yeah.
More fully know the man. So I was thinking about that this week.
Good. So there was an article about something that's hard to make head nor tails of. It's just a reminder there's a wide world and it's not all like the United States or even New York. It's called there's a Danish feel-good political festival, heavy on the beer, according to the Times, and it's called Folkmode, depending on what pronunciation you find on the internet. And what it is a gathering in Denmark of political leaders and everyday people who get together to talk about political issues. And they do it in a small, very remote setting where there's also music and there's beer. And
it's on some crazy island.
Yes.
Like you have to take a ferry to get to the...
Yes, you have to go to a place called... You have to go to a place called Bornholm. Of population of 40,000, you have to head to the southern tip of Sweden. You have to take a ferry to the island and drive for a half hour to a linge on winding roads that cut through villages with stone churches and green fields billowing in the sea breeze. It's hard to get to. As I said, it was population 40,000, 115,000 people descend on this small village to go to this festival.
That's a huge percentage.
I don't know where they stay. It's a big Airbnb thing, I guess. But and they
must all camp out.
You know, they have photos here that look like these big beer hall situations. Everyone's casually dressed because it's such an arduous journey to get there.
They want to talk politics. They're just there to talk politics.
And they have small gatherings.
Does anybody die? Is there violence?
No. Apparently, they're very cordial. So much so that while they talk politics. And I should say, they have big-time people there. They say here that they had the head of the European Union Competition Commission, Margaret Vestager. I mean, which is crazy that they have such big-time leaders there. And yet, it's small gatherings, and they tend not to talk about the most difficult political issues.
The hot-button issues?
So the hot-button issue is immigration. So when people fill out what they want to talk about and what they want to attend and so, even though it's easily the biggest issue in Denmark, it came in number 20 in terms of the things people want to talk about and what they ended up talking about. So they're very civil to each other. It's more in the way of local issues. They give an example of one woman who's a doctor who traveled 7 hours to talk to officials about her concerns about her hospital's psychiatric ward and how it needs more funding. And the officials listen, they say, well, do something about that. Will get you more funding. It's more on that level, what I'll call local politics, that it seems to be effective. But at the same time, they interviewed her husband, and they asked him what he thought, and he said, look, you know, it's the music and the beer. If they didn't have that, no one would come here. So, and yet it's just such a strange thing to bring that.
So are you suggesting we do this next year instead of a bike trip?
No, No, I'm not. But it's interesting to ask the question is whether you could do something like this in the U.S. And the answer, of course, is no. And why is that? That's a longer discussion. But it's such a different culture that it would support, you know, and nurture such a program. Can't imagine any place in the United States doing something like that.
So if anyone's interested in going,
yeah,
they need to know Danish.
Yes, I should have mentioned that.
And all the discussions are in Danish.
Yes, all discussions are in Danish. That's true. So we'll put off those plans until you master Danish.
Okay, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
Museum update. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of tips.
Yes.
Okay, number one, how about the Jewish Museum in New York? They're having an exhibition called Flesh, which is showing the work of Chaim Soutine. And he was a painter originally from the area we now call Belarus, mm-hmm. who emigrated to Paris around 1913. He lived from 1893 to 1943. And he's interesting because of his style, much more involved in texture, shape, color over representation. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of a bridge to what we might call, you know, the New York School, that abstract expressionist style. So he's fun. He's interesting. It's very visceral stuff, literally. I mean, he painted animal cadavers. So that may be off-putting to some, but his style is really, to me, engaging. And it was also engaging to Albert Barnes, who's a guy who collected, as you know, like Matisse, Renoir, you know, et cetera, also had a thing for Soutine. So that's at the Jewish Museum till September in New York City. Also in New York City at the Frick, okay? The refined, dignified, sedate Frick. There's a new exhibition of a model of a statue, a sculpture of George Washington, okay? It was a sculpture done by Antonia Canova originally. It was commissioned by the North Carolina State Legislature, okay? They actually asked Thomas Jefferson for his input about who should do the sculpture. He recommended Canova. And they got this fabulous statue. It's installed in about 1821 in the state capitol. They have even built a dome to put over it. So it's, you know, it's really got pride of place. 10 years after it's installed, there's a big fire and the dome falls and crushes the statue. Okay, so for years, nobody has seen this statue, but in Italy was the model, the plaster model for that sculpture. And so now there's an exhibition of that model, the modello, we call it, and also, you know, preliminary works that lead up to it, sketches, the life mask that the artist worked from, etc. Okay, here's the thing. The sculpture itself?
Yeah.
You saw the picture.
Yeah.
It's a little goofy.
Yeah, it's awful.
To our way of thinking, it doesn't really look like George.
No.
And he's wearing a skirt.
Yeah, it's silly. It doesn't.
He's dressed as a Roman general.
If you showed it to someone, they'd never say that's George Washington.
So that's pretty funny. So it made me think about a couple of other sculptures of George Washington. And of course, the sculpture that preceded this was a big hit in the United States, was done by Jean-Antoine Houdon, who was a French sculptor of the late 18th, early 19th century. Also recommended by Thomas Jefferson to the Virginia legislature. Mm-hmm. And this is sculpted while George Washington is alive. And George says, I want to be in pants.
Yeah, okay. Sure.
So he's dressed as a general. And, you know, it has various neoclassical symbolism in it. But, you know, it's a life standing sculpture. He looks very dignified. Houdin even came to the U.S., made a plaster cast, a life mask of Washington's face, so he would get it right. By the way, that life mask is in the Frick exhibition. So there is that. So this Modella would be fun to see. It also brings to mind another neoclassical sculpture of George Washington done at the 100th anniversary of his birth, later by Horatio Greeno. And that is commissioned by, I think, Congress. And that's meant to sit in the Capitol. Greeno actually sculpts George Washington as pretty much as Zeus,
right,
as an enormous god, bare-chested, sitting on a throne. It's a little overwhelming. It lasted in the Capitol, I think, about 20 minutes. Then they put it out on the lawn, on the mall.
Right.
Okay. And now it's in the Smithsonian. And it just, I think, underscores the difference of the way perhaps Europeans look at their leaders, okay, and Americans, you think, or?
I don't know. That's a generalization I'm not sure I know enough to say about. I mean, I don't know. Do you think that's the difference between Europeans and the U.S.?
I think fundamentally we look at our leaders
in a more naturalistic way, as normal people. Well, they're not divine.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe that's the difference. Maybe it's more of elected leaders as opposed to, divine right.
The sculptures were made at a time when basically Americans were trying to be cool like the Europeans, okay? Trying to, be sophisticated and cultured, and that meant adopting all these, Western European tropes of the importance of antiquity and the Greeks and the Romans.
You know, there also could have been, frankly, a disconnect between the classes, the learned classes, the group that included Jefferson, let's say, trying to be cool, thinking of European standards, and the normal people who may have had a different view of things and would have been, frankly, a little bit put off by what Jefferson had imported here in terms of the quality of the sculpture and putting him in that kind of antiquity setting. I mean, that there could be that disconnect also. It's really hard to know. You have a populist, point of view that might have been different than the leaders of the country.
I will say that Frick, Henry Clay Frick, didn't own very much American art at all. Okay, the idea of art in his time was European.
Really?
So this is an opportunity to look at art and portraiture from that point of view.
Right.
And it's wacky.
I'm with the Houdon?
Washington in a skirt.
The Houdon? Houdon? Is that the right
name? You like Houdon?
Yeah.
Okay.
That one makes sense to me. Speaking of what doesn't make sense, though, it's the Mets. And we're not going to dwell on the Mets because the Mets are a sad story. It comes up because one of our most loyal listeners, Armand Evers, has reminded us that it's Bobby Bonilla Day. Bobby Bonilla Day is a day in which Bobby Bonilla receives a check for $1.1 million.
How much?
$1.1 million. It's really $1.2. Who was Bobby Bonilla, you ask? He was a player for the Mets, a free agent that the Mets signed for a fair bit of money some years back. But when it came time to buy him out because he didn't play very well and he was getting older, rather than write him a check in cash, the Mets said, well, let's backload this. We'll make you payments on a regular basis starting in some future year, 10 years hence. So at that point, 1999 versus 2011. And we'll pay you a regular amount, $1.2 million, until the year 2030 or so. Well, that's fine. It's 2035.
Wait a minute,
2035. So now you've got a guy who people barely remember, who didn't play well for the Mets, who's taking $1.2 million from their payroll every year until 2035.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's sort of a metaphor for the team, generally speaking. The Times writes this week that the Mets have hit the trifecta: bad, hopeless, and dull. And it's all true, and was punctuated by the spectacle of the press conference they had last week. Not to be unsympathetic, we're all sympathetic, but it was the press conference where Sandy Alderson announced he was backing off because he had a remission of cancer.
No, and he had...
His announcement was, I had a remission of cancer, I'm backing... Not a remission, a reoccurrence of cancer. And he was going to back off, and he wasn't up to the task. The problem with that, there are many problems with that. Again, sympathy to Sandy, who's really a nice guy, and he did the best he could. But it was very odd. It was odd for a number of reasons. One is that, first of all, the reoccurrence of cancer happened in April. It happened some time ago. So the timing was kind of odd. He wasn't really announcing that the cancer had reoccurred. He was really announcing that he was backing off or being asked to back off. I don't know what that was. But the way it was put together was that he was so down about the whole situation. He spent 10 minutes talking about all his failures, which you never see. And he basically said, I made 8 moves this offseason. Signed 8 different players, all failures. They're all terrible. They're all performing poorly.
Wow.
And to hear the guy go through that, it was just awful. And now where the Mets are is that they don't have leadership. They've decided that they're going to think about who the next leader should be. They can't be asked to make that decision, you know, in a hurry. So they've appointed a triumvirate, sometimes referred to in the press as the three tenors. Three lesser employees or assistant general manager types who will manage the team or general manage the team together for a while, which is, of course, an awful idea because it's very hard to make these decisions generally. You certainly can't make them by committee, so the Mets will be stymied. They won't be able to do anything significant.
Well, it can't get any worse, Dan.
It can't get worse, but they're not even open to doing anything that could dramatically improve the team because you can't do it. If you're thinking in the back of your mind, you may be hiring a new general manager that's not with the team now, who might be looking to take the team in a different direction. You can't hamstring that person by trading away some real talent that he would have wanted to hold on to. So you're stuck. You're stuck.
Wow.
So anyway, it's kind of a sad story. But in any event, you saw something about...
On a lighter note,
yes.
There was a fun story in the New York Times this week about Rick's Cafe. You know, the restaurant in Casablanca, the famous movie Casablanca. And actually, a woman, a former American diplomat, Kathy Krieger, who was stationed in Morocco for many years, and she had been a fan of Casablanca. She first saw it, when she was, in her 20s in Portland, hometown of Portland. And she was astonished when she was stationed in Morocco to find there was no actual Rick's Cafe. So when she retired, she actually cashed in her 401k and determined to actually create a Rick's Cafe.
This must have been some 401k. Yeah.
Rick's Cafe American. Well, you're right. It wasn't enough money. And so she sets about emailing friends and raising money. And she also gets a bank loan, et cetera. And she pulls together enough to do that. I should note, she's raising this money in 2002, and actually she has the foresight to actually explain to the American Treasury Department why all this money is flowing into Morocco from America.
Right.
Nonetheless, one of her contributors actually gets interviewed by the FBI.
Wow.
But she does buy this beautiful old building in Medina in the old part of Casablanca, and it seems to be quite successful. She has 5 different dining rooms over 2 floors. She even managed to hire a manager, Issam Chaba, who plays the piano.
Yeah.
And when he came in for his interview, actually sat down and started playing, play it as time goes by. So his name is Issam, and people often say to him, you know, play it again, Sam, and he corrects them. My name is Issam.
Right.
So that is kind of a dream come true for her. She is 72 at this point. It's been open for 14 years.
Wow.
She says, this is my assisted living center.
Wow.
Which
that's
is
amazing.
One way, you know, we're always thinking about what do you do when you retire?
You start a restaurant in Morocco. That's what I
was
thinking.
Well, you do something that keeps you engaged and, dealing with people. And that's
amazing. 14 years. That I didn't know. 14 years. That's a success. That's a big restaurant. All right. And at the close, we should say, well, first of all, happy 4th of July again. And I don't know if we're going to get the fireworks tonight. I did notice that TCM had two movies on. One, of course, 1776, which you were saying.
Oh, really?
You're okay. Saying your mother was watching.
She
this
recently
movie.
Watched it. That is one of that's got to be one of my favorite musicals. That's a lot of fun. The kids turned me on to it. Actually, yeah. They when they were in like 6th and 7th grade, their government classes, yeah. They would listen to that and watch it, and I just think it's terrific. And so did my mom, actually, after all these years.
Yeah. No, you were telling me you were just visiting your mom, and she was going on about it, and she didn't remember whether she had seen it before.
Right. But she's seen it now, and she likes it.
Yeah. But the other movie that's on TCM tonight is Yankee Doodle Dandy. Did you ever see Yankee Doodle Dandy?
I'm not sure.
So that's Jimmy Cagney as George M. Cohan.
Right.
Right,
I'm Yankee Doodle Dandy. I've certainly seen excerpts over and over again.
You know,
because you think of him as sort of a gangster type,
right?
And the idea
Cagney.
Of him tap dancing.
Cagney, not Cohan. Yes,
yeah.
It is unbelievable. That's right. It's like seeing Humphrey Bogart go out and do this amazing tap dancing, and it is amazing tap dancing. It is a great movie.
Okay,
I
take your word for it.
Yes, over there. Oh, it's fantastic. So, in any event, we close. Lillian Montevecchi passed away. Lillian Montevecchi was a Broadway performer, a dancer. She was on television. She was in movies. And what's interesting is that she had what I'd call mixed success. She's French. She grew up in Paris. Her father is Italian. And she appeared in a range of films, often with Leslie Caron, because they were dance-oriented films. But she wasn't what you would call a big star. And it was at the age of 50. That she got a part in Nine, in the musical Nine, and they rewrote a part in Nine. There was going to be a producer. It was supposed to be a man. They rewrote it to be a woman.
Huh.
Which is kind of interesting because they were so impressed with her. And she won a Tony for Nine. And then she was in what's the hotel movie we saw?
Grand Hotel.
Grand Hotel. She was in the original cast of Grand Hotel.
So she was the aging ballerina.
Exactly, in Grand Hotel.
Okay.
And then she became really a cabaret star. But what I remember most for was she was in the concert production of Follies. And there was a song, and that's, of course, Pastiche that Sondheim wrote. And he had all these sort of cabaret-type numbers, really, in the show, all these performance numbers. And it's about an old Ziegfeld Follies troupe. And she performs...
They were having a reunion after many years.
Exactly right. And she would have been, you know, when she did this, she was in her 60s, and they're all about in their 60s, getting together, doing the kind of things they did when they were 25. And she performs a song that's in the style of Marlene Dietrich. And it's called... But Au Paris, and it's fantastic. The theme of the song basically is you can go to a lot of different cities for a lot of different things, and they're brilliant Sondheim lyrics, but if it's love that you are looking for, Paris. So we'll leave you playing the music from Follies with Lillian Montevecchi, and happy 4th
of
July.
And this is Tamsin Granger.
Dan Abuhoff.
Saying goodbye, we'll see you next week.
At Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.
New York has neon, Berlin has bars, but Paris, Shanghai has silk and Madrid guitars. But Paris, in Cairo you find bizarre bazaar, in London beep you sip tea. But when it comes to love, none of the above compares Paris. So if it's making love that you're thinking of, Paris. I have seen the ruins of Rome. I have been to the igloo of Nome. I've gone to Moscow, it's very gay. Well, anyway, on the 1st of May, I have been to Rangoon and Soho. And I like them more than so, so bad.